So when I arrived this morning, I made sure that I checked in with what we were actually meant to be covering here over the weekend and realized it was quite an ambitious chunk of material. So we'll see how we go, and hopefully we'll at least have an overview of this body of teaching. First of all, I'd like to say thank you to you for coming. London Insight really is you. All of you who come, all of you who volunteer, all of you who are willing to practice and to give this time. And I am always delighted to come and teach here every year. I have a great deal of admiration for what London Insight does and what it has done over these many years of beginning really to establish an urban community, an urban sangha, and a teaching center. And I think it really has been of benefit to so many. So, yes, delighted to be here also. Apart from turning off the phones, which is really, a real gift to yourself. We're so accustomed to being always on call. And in truth, mostly the world does get on without us for a day. And we can see whether we can get on without being fed endless amounts of information or who needs to talk to us. So really, please, not just turning them off, but not using phones in the grounds of the school during the day. We will endeavor, and this is something, it's an unusual situation. We endeavor to create a little bit of an oasis of silence and contemplation in the midst of this busy city, in the midst of this busy world. And we actually really do that together. I'm always astonished about how retreats are born of a kind of collective intention and a collective commitment. A couple of months ago, I was teaching a retreat in Ireland, and I hadn't paid any attention to where the retreat was being held. I sometimes feel a bit like a parcel that just gets transported and arrives somewhere. So I was a little surprised when we arrived at this castle. And I'd never taught a retreat in a castle before. But then I was even more surprised to discover we were sharing the castle with the Fijian rugby team who was there training for the World Cup. And we were sharing the castle with 40 Benedictine monks and various groups that were coming in for away days, like from Dell and places like that. So it was a sort of busy environment, It was a kind of busy place. And around the first day, I thought, it doesn't actually get any better than this. It doesn't get any better than this. Because I just saw that through people's intention, to hold their silence, to know what they were doing there, to know why they were there, I saw this group of people, this group of meditators just moving through this environment, almost like gliding through this environment, being not kind of contracted and defensive, but actually really resting within their intention and their knowing of creating this dedicated space amidst all of this busyness. And I teach in so many places where every effort is made to make the conditions absolutely perfect, so that no one is ever disturbed by anything being amiss or any noise, or anything not running absolutely smithily. And I started to question, I appreciate those places, and a lot of people appreciate those places, but they're far removed from the rest of our lives. And it's the rest of our lives that we're asked to live within, about how to have an oasis of intentionality amidst the conditions that we can't always control. And so we make that commitment here together to remember why we're here. And I think there's always a kind of reorientation that happens when we arrive on a retreat, no matter how short or how long it is. It's more than just physically arriving. There's a kind of psychological, emotional adjustment that needs to happen. And it's a part of mindfulness. It's that part of mindfulness which is about remembering why we are here, what we are dedicated to. And I always feel that there's some value as we begin a period of practice to asking ourselves, you know, what would it be helpful for us to quite intentionally let go of in order to be here most fully, most wholeheartedly? You know, and we could reflect on that question. You know, and I think if people responded to that question, yes, some of the responses might be very, very individual. And some of them would be quite universal. I think we remember we might need and really encourage ourselves to let go of the habits of busyness, the habits of overdoing, the habits of impatience, the habits of judging, the habits of lethargy, the habits of having divided attentiveness, which is how we so easily live our lives. Would this be helpful for us to let go of in order to be here most fully? And what would it be helpful for us really to commit to and to cultivate in order to be here most fully? And again, some of those responses might be quite personal. Some of them may be very, very universal. It may be very important that we commit to cultivating the capacity for patience, for kindness, for generosity, for perseverance, for the willingness to begin again in all the moments of forgetfulness, to know that this is a possibility for us. I'm so appreciative of the teaching from one of the early texts when the Buddha says, you know, all we are now is the result of all that we have been. And that all that we will be tomorrow or even in the next moment will be the result of all that we are now. And I think that all we are now is actually what we commit ourselves to, the sense of what serves us well and what serves our community well. Also, sensing as we begin this weekend, I always feel this is just a helpful reminder that, you know, we don't undertake this journey, we don't undertake this practice, which can be so challenging at times. We don't do it just for our own well-being. You know, we walk on this pathway for the well-being of those that we love and care for the people that we struggle with, for the many people that we don't know. And I was so struck this morning and thinking, well, you know, yes, that is why we do this. And holding also for a moment just an awareness of all of the people in Paris whose lives have been so tragically changed by hatred and by ill will. And how, you know, the Buddha so strongly taught that hatred is never healed by hatred, but by kindness and by understanding is hatred healed. So we begin. You know, the Buddha got up from the Bodhi tree and on the eve of his awakening. And we're told that when he got up from the Bodhi tree, he said, "I have done what needs to be done." I find that quite an interesting statement. Does anybody here feel they've done what needs to be done? I've just done what needs to be done. He says, you know, suffering has come to an end, struggle has come to an end, and I'm awake. It's quite a profound statement. But then when the Buddha began teaching and teaching what that awakening meant to him, he didn't teach it as, he didn't go out and say, you know, gosh, last night I had this amazing experience under that tree, you know, and everybody should go and try to have that same amazing experience, you know. And, you know, I can't tell you how many years I practiced in Asia along with others of community of people chasing their own Bodhi tree experience with much frustration. No, he didn't talk about an experience. He didn't talk about having some transcendent mystical state. He actually talked about an understanding. He talked about a radical understanding that changed the way that he saw life, the way that he saw himself, the way that he saw the world. And he talked about an understanding so deep and so cellular that he saw the world through the eyes of this understanding. And that it was an understanding, an insight that really did bring this sense of inner freedom, this sense of awakening, of liberation, and an understanding that did bring that world of struggle and suffering to an end. So over the weekend, I want to reflect, and for us to reflect together on those domains of understanding that the Buddha talked about, because I think it's so important to remember that the Buddha always sought for graduates. He didn't seek for perpetual students or followers. What he sought for and encouraged was for people to come to exactly the same liberating insights that he had come to himself. It is really, I think, one of the kind of primary legacies of the Buddha's teaching was this invitation to explore the landscape of awakening, the landscape of inner freedom. But the Buddha also talked about these understandings being embodied. He says if we don't live these understandings, they have little meaning. And that the understandings that he came to really were the doorway to living a life of very profound compassion and care and responsiveness and relatedness and creativity and participation in this world. In this world. So we come to this word insight. I always find it quite... It's a good word to reflect on. What does it mean for us? You know, many people describe their pathways or describe themselves as practicing insight meditation, you know, and one goes on insight meditation retreats. And, you know, it's kind of one of those words that we don't really talk about that much, interestingly. You know, and I think sometimes when we kind of emphasize insight, you know, there can be people who sit there quite quietly thinking, uh-oh, you know, what does an insight look like? You know, what are the insights I'm supposed to have? You know, how will I know if I have them? You know, and what are the right insights? And, you know, it becomes a kind of slight sort of uneasiness or embarrassment. And, you know, my understanding that there's insights are not necessarily big epiphany moments. They don't come with great drama. You know, one doesn't suddenly have a sort of, you know, a moment where the lights go on and you think, oh, now, oh, yes. I mean, sometimes insights do come that way. But mostly, for most people, I think that the journey of insight is a very quiet journey. It's a very quiet journey of an inner transformation, an inner change, where we begin to recognize in ourselves, you know, the pathways that we follow that lead to distress. We begin to recognize in ourselves a sense of capacity that we actually have choices, and that we hold in our hands the capacity to choose what pathways we might follow in our hearts and our minds. Sometimes we don't know that something is changing, and yet how many people come to me and report that they've, you know, suddenly found themselves going into a very familiar situation which maybe in the past was shadowed by irritation or anxiety or anger, and suddenly find that they can turn up and it's not that way anymore. And something has changed, something has deeply changed, something has fallen away. A person might suddenly report that they find themselves, to their surprise, being far more generous than judging, far more patient than frustrated, far more confident than doubtful. And these are all the ways in which, you know, sometimes it doesn't seem like we're doing very much in our practice. You know, we sit around a lot, you know, we have little walks, you know. My son has taken pictures of my daily retreat schedules and emailed them to his friends and, you know, said what a cushy job his mother has, you know. She just sits around, and occasionally she has a little toddle and then she sits around a lot more. But we know it's not like that. You know, we know it's not like that. We know that as we undertake this practice, it's a pathway of sensitizing ourselves. It's a pathway of becoming more intimate with ourselves. It's a pathway of coming to know this mind, but also really a more universal mind. The patterns, the pathways that the human mind can follow. Some of them so wonderful, and some of them causing so much difficulty. And in doing this, we're sowing seeds, constantly sowing seeds. You know, I rather love the sort of agricultural metaphors that the Buddha used, you know, that we're cultivating, we're nourishing, we're planting seeds of kindness, we're planting seeds of stillness, we're planting seeds of calmness, we're planting seeds of curiosity. And through our practice, the gentle dedication we bring to just being here in this moment and listening inwardly, we're actually cultivating the conditions in which those seeds can grow and can flourish and really become embodied in our life. When I think of insight, I almost put it into sort of different domains, almost different categories, just as a way of understanding this landscape that we talk about. And I think the first domain of insight has very much to do with our personal story, our personal narrative. I mean, you will find today as you sit and walk, you know, that your life follows you onto the cushion and onto your walking path. And why would it not? And here we're not trying to explain that life. We're not trying to find a solution for all our struggles. We're not trying to find explanations and we're certainly trying not just to walk in those same familiar loops that are so habitual. But we're learning to listen. And you know, I think there's many parts of meditative settings where the domain of personal insight is often kind of dismissed as being, you know, oh, really, that's just therapy, you know, or that's just, you know, getting lost in the story. But I think it's a little bit of a dismissive tone that's not helpful. I see the domains of insight as not being linear or hierarchical, but being very interwoven. When you sit on your cushion and when you go on your walking path, I mean, who do you meet? You know, you don't meet Fred Jones from down the road. You know, you meet yourself. You meet the life of your body. You meet the life of your mind. You meet the life of your heart. You meet the world of your heartaches and struggles and pains and difficulties. You meet the moments of care and compassion. And I don't think that anybody bypasses themselves on the way to liberation. You know, I have seen people who try to do this. And it often becomes a whole lot of forcing and striving and denial and kind of bypassing of ourselves. And we begin to sense that this, you know, this fragile life of our body, our minds, our hearts, really merits listening, really merits care, really merits compassion. And that this fragile life held within this mind-body experience is actually the classroom of our awakening. And this is what the Buddha taught over and over again. He said, don't look outside of yourself. Everything that needs to be understood can be understood within the length of this body. Everything that needs to be understood can be understood within the world of this heart and this mind. This dimension of personal insight is really where we learn some of the most important lessons in relationship to our own mind-body experience. I think we learn most of the important and ennobling qualities, the paramis of patience and generosity and forgiveness and kindness and compassion. And we learn that even though distress can exist and does exist, there is a way of being in ourselves where we're no longer so obliged to compound distress through aversion or through resistance or through judgment. We can learn to change the shape of our minds. You know, Nyanaponikatera, one of the early teachers, he often formulated this journey in three ways. He says, you know, to know the mind or to know the heart, to shape the mind or to shape the heart, and to liberate the mind, liberate the heart. And it begins with knowing. You know, we're learning to bring a calm awareness into the midst of all of this where we already stand. You know, equanimity is sometimes described as standing in the middle of all things. We already are there. We already are there. But we learn to stand in the middle of all things with poise and with balance, with understanding, with curiosity. There's a lot, I think, in this domain of personal insight, which is about peacemaking. It's about peacemaking. You know, the Buddha once described liberation as being the freedom from debt. And he used the metaphor, he says, imagine, you know, if you're in debt financially and you experience the burden of all of that, the anxiety, the worry, the sense of a weight on your life of, you know, always being kind of confined by what you owe. And he says, imagine if you were in that situation and you were suddenly able to repay all of your debts. And the kind of freedom and the lightness that would come with that, the sense of the world opening rather than being so contracted. And he says, within this domain of our relationship to our own being, we are also learning about the freedom from being indebted. And if we want to know what we're indebted to, we just really need to be aware of what our attention continually obsesses about. Because this is what we are not at peace with. And in those moments, we sometimes ask ourselves, you know, what is needed? What does this need? Does it need an outer act of peacemaking? Does it need an inner act of peacemaking? Does it need the capacity to free ourselves from the contractedness of self-description, identifying, defining ourselves by the contents of our experience? Does this need simply listening and caring for? The second domain of insight that the Buddha speaks about, and we will cover a lot of this territory over this weekend, is what is traditionally called in this teaching the three marks or the three characteristics of existence, of life, of anicca, change, dukkha, unsatisfactoriness or stress or discontent, and anatta, or non-self. And when the Buddha got up from the Bodhi tree, it was these three areas of understanding that he spoke about most in his whole teaching life. And he said, to understand these three eternal laws or these three marks of experience is to liberate the heart, to liberate the mind from all distress, and liberates our capacity to truly live an awakened life. So we will go into these in much more detail over the weekend. And the third dimension of insight is really kind of, it's not a dimension in itself. It's really a maturation of the first two domains of insight. So it is that domain of insight when the Buddha says, I've done what needs to be done. It means his understanding is unshakable. It's unshakable. It really is the uprooting of distress and its causes. It's really appreciating the potentiality of the human heart to abide in understanding and to embody those understandings in every area of our lives. Okay, I think that's a good place to start. And I think